This episode is brought to you by DistroKid.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Hey everybody, today's guest is Rachel Bowen, bassist, lyricist, and songwriter for the Toms River, New Jersey rock band, Skid Row. Together we take a deep dive into the writing, recording, and inspiration behind their 1989 smash hit single, 18 in Life, taken from their self-titled debut album. I told Rachel that I always felt Skid Row had a lot more to offer, both musically and especially lyrically, than most of their 80s and early 90s counterparts, 18 in Life being a prime example of this. The imagery and storytelling within the lyric is great and highly relatable. We talked about producer Michael Wagner's involvement and how he was the perfect person to take their great ideas and expound on them, improving the parts that were already awesome and weeding out the parts that weren't. We both agreed that the best producers work as armchair psychologists, getting into the psyche of the musicians and making the music truly come alive. It was cool to hear Rachel talk about first hearing the mix come back from the song and being totally blown away. After all, this was their debut album, and he had previously never heard his band sound as massive and as great as this. For all this and a story about jet skiing in between bass performances, stick around. This is a good one.
Hey, hey, have you heard? Krista makes a podcast. Hey, hey, have you heard? Krista makes a podcast. Hey, hey, have you heard? Krista makes a podcast.
Rachel, how's it going?
It's going great, man. It's been an eventful year musically, believe it or not.
Well, you guys are what I call lifers. You just never stopped. You're still out there year after year doing your thing. And I know you were busy this morning talking to your record label about your new record. That's always fun.
Yeah. You know, just bouncing ideas off of each other and getting right to the brink of sort of an argument, but not really. Let's not say argument. Let's say disagreement. But yeah, it's things are going really well, man. You know, we have this record deal with Ear Music out of Germany, who did they do Alice Cooper and Deep Purple, and things are going well, and got a lot of shows on the books for this year.
That's very cool. Well, for the listeners, Skid Row formed back in 1986, and I want you to take us back to that time period, because not saying you guys didn't pay your dues. Every band has a different story. Some bands have to fight it out in the clubs for 10 years before they get a deal, but it seems relatively quick. I know that you and Dave, the Snake Szabo, had formed the band in 86. And then I believe Scotty and Rob came shortly thereafter. Is that correct?
Yeah. Before Skid Row, actually, Scotty Hill and I had a band together. And then when we were looking for another guitar player, Scotty came in, and it went from like one lead guitar to two lead guitars, and it just kind of really shaped the whole Skid Row sound.
And I know that, of course, Dave has history. I believe he went to school with John Bon Jovi. Mm-hmm. At the time, Bon Jovi's manager was Doc McGee, who took you under his wing. So it just seems like the next thing you knew, you had a singer named Matt Fallon, who I believe just did maybe some demos with you guys.
He did shows too. And he was there right up until about 88, I guess. You know, or maybe 87, something like that. But yeah, we did a bunch of shows with Matt and a ton of demos.
And then, of course, I want to say it said 88. I'm thinking it was probably late summer, early fall. You guys were at Royal Recorders in Lake Geneva, Wisconsin, of all places, with Michael Wagner making the first record.
Yeah.
So today we're going to talk about 18 in Life. Take us back. Where was that written between 86 and 88, if you recall?
We wrote it, and we were all living at home at the time. Snake was living in Sayreville. I was in Toms River, New Jersey. And, you know, we'd just drive back and forth and write. he actually worked in Toms River. So a lot of times we'd write at my parents' house, and whether it was in my room or out on the back porch. And we, he goes, man, I got this riff. He goes, it kind of has an Aerosmith feel to it, kind of a Kings and Queen type of thing. And he played it, and he was singing some of the melody and told me some of the lyrics. And immediately, as soon as he started playing it, I was like, dude, that is so haunting. Like, that is so, so haunting. And things just kind of started falling into place really quick with that song. And it started off a completely different topic and a completely different story than just turned into the story of a kid losing his way. And the character Ricky, who I'm sure everybody in their life knows a guy like this that just can't get out of his own way. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And that's how the whole storyline started evolving.
Well, I always love this song, and I picked this one. Obviously, you guys have a number of hits, especially on the first two records. The breakout single, the leadoff single from the record Skid Row, self-titled, that was released on January 24th, 89, was Youth Gone Wild. Awesome song. And of course, the ballad from the record, I Remember You. Stratospheric for you guys. It sent you into the stars. It was a massive hit. But this one, you know, it's interesting looking back at that time period. By the late 80s, you know, a lot of my friends were kind of getting tired with the whole glam thing, and it started to really become cliche. Mm-hmm. And you were one of the bands that stuck out with this song in particular. It wasn't about partying and women and whatever else. This had a story behind it, like all the great songwriters. So how did this lyric come about?
Well, like I said, it first started off as a song about Snake's older brother and his of going to Vietnam and one person and coming back a different person. And then it just started changing as the lyrics developed and the story developed. It started becoming more general instead of being a story about that one person is telling it. It developed into a story that a lot of people could tell, because I mean, let's face it, we all know a guy like the character in the song.
Sure.
And you know, sometimes it got so dark that we're like, okay, let's back off some of these lyrics and let's just change this. But that's how it all developed. And it really, after we had that in mind of what the actual storyline was, everything was very organic and it just all came together really quick. There were some changes here and there, like the one line, "You can't think of dying when the bottle's your best friend," was originally, "You can't think of dying when the devil's your best friend." But one of us said, man, I think the devil is just too cartoony and stuff like that, when it's just being too general. Let's just say, okay, this guy has a problem and he killed his friend because he was all messed up. And so it just kind of developed like that. And then, you know, we are storytellers and a lot of our songs do tell stories. I don't know whether that's a Jersey thing or not, because I mean, Springsteen is like the king of it.
Man, you took the words out of my mouth. Yeah. I'm telling you, I don't care if it's the hard rock guys, the Springsteens, the metal guys, the punk guys, they all tell it's like this rough and tumble from the streets type story, right?
We are all storytellers, man. I mean, you get four guys from Jersey in a room and the stories just never end. Never end.
Yeah.
And one's trying to top the other one, you know?
Sure. And I'll tell you, looking back, I'm surprised, because MTV, you know, I think sometimes maybe they use this as an excuse. They didn't like the song, or they didn't know how to say no to this particular manager, but they would use the excuse of, we can't air this, because it talks about a gun a couple times in the song, you know?
Yeah.
It's amazing that it did get on, because it was weird. It was weird back then.
Well, yeah. And there were a lot of MTV pushbacks. One in particular is, there was one edit where the character of Ricky actually pointed the gun at his friend's head and his friend swats it away. they didn't like that. So you just see the him grabbing the gun, then you see the other dude swatting it away. In hindsight, that was the right thing to do. That was really the right thing to do, for real, especially the way things are now. You know what I mean?
Sure.
With as crazy as things have happened with shootings and stuff, that was the absolute right thing to do. There was another scene where there was going to be blood that was running down the sidewalk into a sewer that we were going to film. And we were like, this probably isn't a good idea, that we just nixed it. It didn't even get filmed to be cut or to be requested to be cut. The thing is, when you tell a story to a huge audience, you have to definitely tell it responsibly. You know what I mean?
Because
there's a fine line between telling a story and an opinion, and it could, you know, so if you want to tell your story, get your story across, you have to be really responsible about it.
There you go. Was Doc McGee an integral part in getting your deal with Atlantic?
Yes, without a doubt. John and Richie were a ton of help. They were a ton of help getting us indoors to play our demos. I mean, Snake and I would go to New York with a bunch of cassettes, and we'd have meetings. Sometimes we'd sit there all day waiting for them to let us in. Sometimes they take us right in. And Atlantic was one of the labels we went up to that were really keen on the band, and they courted us for a long time. But yeah, we would go to New York in the freezing cold or in the blazing heat and just tough it out. You know, do we have enough money for a cab and to get back home on the train? No. Okay. Let's walk. It looks like we're walking uptown, you know? So, it was a lot of great memories actually, but yeah, Doc, was very instrumental in getting to the deal to where it was. And, you know, cause we were, Atlantic was after us, and we felt really comfortable with Dorothy and with Jason, the A&R, and we felt really comfortable about it.
Is that Jason Flom?
Jason Flom and Dorothy, yeah. Caravello. And then, you know, we had the Toon Jarum and Doug Morris and Ahmet Erdogan came to show and all that stuff. And it was a big deal, you know, but in the 11th hour, there was interest from Geffen. And Doc called, he said, okay, we're going to sign with Geffen. And we're like, well, what about all of our friends at Atlantic? You know, we've developed relationships with them. And I should say, this was the 11th hour. They came back and it was for a little bit more money, and which we were kids. We didn't care about the money. We wanted to go where we thought was a good home for us. And the fact that their idea, the producer that Geffen wanted us to work with, and Geffen and the A&R guy himself, we'd scrap like all of our songs except for two. And it was really weird, man. It's like the only two that they kept out of 30 that we played at a showcase was Making a Mess and 18 in Life. They said, start writing. And we were just like, whoa, man, this is crazy. We're just starting from square one, man. And then, That's
wild.
And that was another reason why we loved Atlantic, because they love the songs, and they're like, man, this represents you guys so perfectly, this music. And because we got to know them on a personal basis, and that's really important. So then they came back, and before we even got pen to paper with Geffen, we signed with Atlantic, and it was a done deal.
Well, producer Michael Wagner, I mean, he's just the list of stuff he's done, everything from Motley Crue, Wasp, Overkill, Great White, Stryper, Poison, Alice Cooper. He mixed Master of Puppets by Metallica. The man is a legend. How did he come into the picture?
Did you know he mixed like the rock version of Black Cat by Janet Jackson?
I read that, yeah, which is amazing,
yeah,
and
that's
awesome.
So cool. Came in, obviously we knew his work.
He was high demand then. You guys were able to snatch him up. I'm sure, yeah. Doc and Atlantic helped with that.
Yeah, well, we met with a bunch of producers, and we just, you know, we liked some of them, but we just didn't vibe. And a lot of them, it seemed like almost like a takeover more than okay, we're working with you, type of thing. And Snake and I would always just be like, and all the guys were like, how do we feel about this? It's like, well, we love the record that he did, but is he going to change us? Like, we don't want to, you know, of course we're going to listen to people and take creative criticism, but we don't want to lose the essence of what we knew Skid Row was. So when we met with Michael, we were playing in Providence, Rhode Island at the place called, do you remember the Living Room up in Providence?
I never played there, but I've heard of it.
Yeah, just a big box. It was a big rectangle
one of those
box. Yeah. So Jason Flom and I believe Doc or Scott McGee brought Michael to the show, and he watched, and you know, he was just coming off of like the stuff he did with White Lion that was blowing up and all that.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're sitting there at this grimy table in the club that is now just a, you know, we had played, and now just it was either in the club. No, we met him in the club, but then we had a talk, I believe, in the lobby of the hotel, and Snake and I were sitting directly across the table from each other, and we were talking. And the one thing Michael said, and, you know, obviously he had all of our respect right from the beginning, but the one thing he said is, I want the band to be the band. And I immediately kicked Snake under the table and went, cool. And then we walked away. We just said to Jason, we got to get him. He gets us. He totally gets us. And he's just like the funniest person. He gets our stupid sense of humor and just the ball busting and all that. And it just right then and there, we knew, we're like, now we're going to do great things with him. And we certainly did.
All the greatest producers, they let the band be themselves, but they elevate what they're hearing.
That's exactly right. He took good parts and made them great. He took good songs and made them great songs. And
yeah,
it was, you know, for us, all of us, it was the first time working with a professional producer. I mean, we always work with the guys that own the studios, which were great. But now we are working on a level that we've never worked before. And he was such a good mentor of how to handle this kind of stuff. And to work in the studio with Michael is like, okay, say you're having just a shit day and before you even get to the studio, and he'll give you, are you okay? Yeah, I'm fine. Let's hit this. I want to forget about this argument I had or whatever, you know, I want to forget about my dog getting hit by a car or whatever. And we work, and he's like, starts clicking lights off. Let's go jet skiing. And we go down to the lake and we go down to Lake Geneva and get on jet skis for like 3 hours, go back to the studio, turn the lights back on, and we'd start nailing stuff. And he'd do that with all of us, you know?
Yeah.
It's because he's like going into a situation and trying to get a good take when your head isn't in it. It's a waste of your time. It's a waste of everyone's time. You're just going to frustrate yourself where it's going to spill over into tomorrow when you're trying to do this again. Fuck it. Let's go shoot, you know, bow and arrows. Let's go shoot guns. You know, let's go blow up fireworks. And, you know,
that is so cool that you brought that up, because I've always said the best producers are poor man psychologists. They really are.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
You know, my band worked with Rob Cavallo some years ago, and Rob was the best at it. And he didn't just act on behalf of the whole band. He would individually know how to talk to each of us.
Oh, yeah.
And say,
yeah,
hey, he'd take you apart. Those are the best producers, man.
Yeah.
And it sounds like Michael was absolutely the right guy for this. Now, the track was released on June 16th, 1989. It was written by yourself and Dave the Snake. The album had 11 songs on it. And here's something I want to know. Did the label, did Doc, did you guys know what the singles were? Because what I found really interesting, that 18 in Life was at number 5 on the record. Youth Gone Wild was number 7. And I Remember You was all the way at number 10 before the 11th track. Typically, your hits are higher up on the track listing. Did you guys know you had a hit with 18 in Life?
No. Okay, so after Youth Gone Wild, we're like, okay, obviously you dream your whole life that you have a hit song. When it happens, you're like, wow, how is it? You're like, what do I do now? I have no idea what to do now. So, and like the splash that made was just ridiculous, way beyond anything that we could have imagined. So we're like, okay, we got to come back with something really good. Like, but at then the typical move would be go with the ballad, go with the full-on acoustic ballad, love song, and you're golden. Our worry was if we did that, because most bands, after they did that, it was like, okay, where's their third single? Nothing. You know,
yeah,
that was our biggest worry. And the fact that Snake and I didn't even want I Remember You on the album, not very smart on our part, but we were really resistant and we're just like, man, we don't think it's a good idea to put that ballad out. And so it was actually Richie Sambora, and he said 18 in Life should be your second single, because it defines you guys. It defines where your head's at. It tells a great story, just like we were talking.
Sure.
And there was a lot of resistance. We dug that idea. We were like, this could be really cool. We liked the idea a lot. There was a lot of resistance from management, from the label, but it sunk in. And, you know, it was at this point, it's just like, all right, sink or swim. It's our second, could be our last shot at anything, no pun intended, but it's like, and it worked out. And I think it had a really cool story, albeit dark. I love the music to that song. I love playing it. And we were hitting on all cylinders, like all five of us. We were just getting everything right with the help of Michael.
Yeah.
But I think it transcended more than just hard rock kids. You know what I mean? And more than just girls with big hair. I think people heard it because, I mean, I was hearing it on like pop radio, like, you know, the real pop stations in New York City. And I was hearing it on stations I never thought I would hear. And I think it had such a big reach out to people that wouldn't necessarily even listen to Skid Row, but then they heard that song and they're like, wow, this song is really cool. I dig it. I know a guy like that. So that was, I'm not going to say it was a calculated move, but it was a really smart move to do that.
Well, I'll tell you, the rollout from this record, I think, was perfect. Youth Gone Wild is a tough song. It's heavy. Could have fit on Slave to the Grind, as far as I'm concerned. Then you went with 18 to Life as the second song. I think Richie was right. It's balladish, but it's heavy.
Yeah.
You know, so you're kind of dipping your toes in a little bit of a softer territory, and then you hit him with I Remember You. I think it's great. I want to jump into the song now. The song is 3 minutes and 51 seconds. There's an 8-bar intro. The first 8 seconds, there's a guitar arpeggio, that haunting guitar part that you're talking about. It's so good. Based around E minor. The guitar with the bass is playing root notes. And then 8 seconds, there's a few ride cymbal hits. The bass goes up for an octave for a second and gets a little busier. At 12 seconds, there's this that's let out. I'm assuming that's Sebastian that's kind of panned off left. Mm-hmm. The bass continues to move. The ride cymbal is keeping time now with single hits on the one beat. And at 14 seconds, there's a high-pitched guitar with 3 single notes that ring out before we get into verse 1. Those little things, I'm always intrigued by the little... Was that like Michael's idea, or was that just something Sebastian threw in there?
It might have been something he threw in there. I'm not quite sure. I wasn't there during the vocals. Michael liked to close the studio when he was doing vocals. But a lot of stuff, you know, we rehearsed. It could have been there in rehearsal. I really don't know, because we rehearsed the shit out of everything back then. We like to be really precise before we step into the studio. At least we did then. And that guitar thing you're talking about with Scotty Hill, and he calls it seagulls.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know what I mean?
I love it.
Yeah. And that is Scotty Hill in a nutshell, with those little things that just, if that wasn't there, it would still have mood, but it wouldn't have that mood. You know what I mean?
Right. Like, oh, sure.
Like that, those 3 notes summed up the whole tone of the song. You know what I mean?
It made it even more haunting. And something that, you know, I talked to Huey Lewis recently, and there was this part in the song, it was like an thing that he did in his song. I can't remember exactly what it was. And I said, what was that? He goes, I was just kind of like warming up my voice and doing something between takes. Bob Clearmountain, who mixed the record, he threw it in there. I'm like, what the heck is that? You know, and back then, before Pro Tools, not everything was edited. You just get everything on tape. Exactly. It was just there, you know.
There, right.
Sometimes, so that ah thing could have just been him, you know, maybe, I don't know, taking a puff off a cigarette. Who knows how that stuff gets in there? I just think it's so cool, yeah. Especially back in the analog days. Verse one, that intro guitar, the bass, and the cymbal on the drum is still there, that ride cymbal. Ricky was a young boy. He had a heart of stone. Lived 9 to 5 and he worked his fingers to the bone. Just barely out of school. Came from the edge of town. Fought like a switchblade so no one could take him down. Oh no.
It
kind of says what it says.
It says what it says. And I like to be a little more poetic about stuff. I believe that first line, when it was the other storyline, was had a heart of gold. And then we kind of kept it like that, but I'm like, this dude wouldn't have a heart of gold. This is contradictory to what this story is about. So we changed it to heart of stone.
It's and, tougher.
Yeah. And then the, we couldn't think of, like we were writing fought like a what. And I was just, all of a sudden, I don't know why I thought of West Side Story when I go fought like a switchblade. And we were like, yes. And you know, yeah, and it just kind of sums up a kid that may not have the greatest home life, and that just kind of spills out into his social skills, you know, and he always had his guard up, you know, no one could take him down. His guard was always up, and he felt it had to be, and it didn't necessarily have to.
On the first half of verse one of the line, live 9 to 5, and he worked. The big drums come in, the big stereo guitars come in and ring out over the second half of verse one. On the second half, love these little nuances. Came from the edge of town. On that line, there's a guitar feedback swell panned off to the left. Mm-hmm. On the switchblade line, between that and the last line of verse one, the stereo guitars are back in, and there's a really cool pinch harmonic that happens before you go into pre-chorus one. How much did the song evolve, if you can recall, from the demo to like at this point in the song? Was there changes? Was the intro shorter? Do you remember?
Yes, it was. Dynamics were added more than anything. I mean, the arrangement was still pretty much the same. We changed the bridge very, very, very slightly. Not chord wise, just like dynamics, you know, like crescendo wise. And that was just one tiny little thing. But those little nuances, like the Scotty Hill nuances and those pinched harmonics and stuff, those were probably something that happened as time went on. You know, I know Scotty was doing those, what he calls the seagulls, in the beginning from from pre-production with Michael. That's pretty much when that started, I believe. Now you have me wondering. I want to go back and listen to the original demo we did with Matt Fallon, but I don't know where the hell it is.
Everything somehow ends up on YouTube sooner or later,
as we all know.
Yeah. On the pre-chorus, the drum feel changes here. The stereo guitars go to eighth note, like kind of palm mutes. But this part is tough. This is like one of the heaviest parts of the song in the pre-chorus. He had no money. No good at home. He walked the streets a soldier, and he fought the world alone, and now it's
that kid. Everything he stands for is within himself, and he has an internal war going on, you know, with himself. People have been telling this kid he's no good for so long that he has believed it. He has been convinced of it, you know? Mm-hmm. So he walks the streets alone. You know, he could be with a million people. He could be with all his friends, but he doesn't realize that.
Hey, don't go anywhere. Krista Makes a Podcast will be right back after a few words from our sponsors.
Looking to elevate your music career? DistroKid is a digital music distribution service that enables musicians to distribute their music to online stores and streaming platforms such as Spotify, Apple Music, YouTube Music, Amazon, Tidal, and many more. DistroKid collects earnings and payments, sending them to you, the artist. With DistroKid, artists unlock a world of possibilities. From easily paying collaborators with splits to securing your music with DistroLock, DistroKid covers all bases. Plus, you can promote your releases with HyperFollow and create eye-catching visuals with a Spotify Canvas generator, all for free. But that's not all. Introducing the DistroKid app, now available on iOS and Android. Artists can manage their releases, view streaming stats, and withdraw earnings, all from the palm of their hand. And for those looking to perfect their sound, check out Mixia. With its simple interface and customizable mastering options, artists can make their music sound polished and professional within minutes. And don't forget about Instant Share, DistroKid's newest feature. Share large files securely with collaborators, producers, and more, ensuring your music streams at the highest quality. Ready to take your music to the next level? Download the DistroKid app and explore their suite of tools today. Plus, listeners can enjoy 30% off their first year by visiting distrokid.com/VIP/demakes. That's distrokid.com/VIP/demakes.
Hey there, I am Johnny Christ from Avenged Sevenfold, and I've got a podcast called Drinks with Johnny you're going to want to check out. I sit down with a bunch of different people from all different walks of life, from professional wrestlers to actors, comedians, fighters, musicians, everything in between. I'm just looking to make some friends and have a good time doing it. So if that sounds like something you're into, go check out Drinks with Johnny, streaming everywhere now.
And now, on with the show.
So before we get into chorus one, I want to talk about a couple things here in pre-chorus one. That pinch harmonic comes in again after no good at home, which is just really cool. And at the last line, and he fought the world alone, and now it's the guitars really open up here to take us into the chorus. Walk the streets of soldier ready. Do you remember Michael talking about those kind of dynamics and those little things?
Yeah, actually, we do there's like that whole series of builds, like that was deliberate. That was all very deliberate. And Michael just wanted us to make it even more deliberate. He's like, I get the drama. And, you know, this is almost like orchestra, like, he goes, I get it. Accentuate that, make that more, just ramp it up. And so we almost got to the point where it felt uncomfortable. And then, you know, we just started loosening it up a little bit, and he that's where Michael was the greatest coach in the world. You know what I mean? On this record, he didn't want to change stuff. He just wanted to take it from level one to level 10, you know?
Right. And the producer is just so important to sometimes be able to tell the guitar player, I know your little noodly guitar part, you really like it, but it just doesn't fit.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Sometimes you need to hear that. Cause when you hear it from your bass player, you get really angry.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah. That's when you sneak over to producers like, do you like that guitar part? No, I don't. Can you please tell him?
Yeah. Yeah. Let's go jet skiing first.
Yeah,
we'll talk about this later.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, the chorus comes quick here at 54 seconds. We're in chorus one.
Yeah,
18 in life, you got it. 18 in life, you know. Your crime is time and it's 18 in life to go. 18 in life, you got it. 18 in life, you know. Your crime is time and it's 18 in life to go. And I noticed all these choruses are all doubled. They're all double choruses.
Yeah.
Was there ever talk about this? Hey, maybe we should only just give them a teaser here on chorus one, or was it always like that?
No, because it was really quick and it was just, it was a short message. So we felt that this was the right length. You know what I mean? It just,
yeah.
Because sometimes, you know, a lot of stuff just calls for a single chorus first and then a double chorus out. But
yeah,
we never thought about shortening it. I mean, the message was really quick and the chorus is really short, you know, in the scope of the song.
You just don't see that a lot on a first chorus,
yeah.
You know, and when I do, it always kind of jumps out at me. The harmonies are really subtle in this song, in the chorus here. It's the only time you get harmonies. They're really subtle, but they're cool. And the lead vocal almost sounds double tracked. Do you recall if the vocals double tracked?
It was.
Okay. You're getting harmonies only on the 18 in life, you got it. And again, talking about that haunting guitar riff, the harmonies here are haunting. Mm-hmm. Who did the harmonies on that part?
I believe Scotty Hill sang those harmonies. I know I didn't do it on this song.
Okay.
But yeah, I believe that was Scotty, and it might have been Scotty and Snake. I know that they do it live. But I'm not 100% sure.
I mean, there could have been a ton of different note choices or harmonies there. I think what you picked was perfect. It's subtle. It doesn't stick out, but without it there, you would notice it being gone. I love harmonies like that.
Yeah.
You know, this chorus is heavy in its own right, but it's not as heavy as the pre-chorus. The guitars are distorted, but they're playing arpeggiated picking pattern. That guitar is off to the left. The other guitar right is got these big chords, and the bass sounds great here, holding down the bottom end. I love the bass tone on that.
Thanks.
Do you recall working on that? Did you come in with a bass sound already as a young musician, or did Michael help you cultivate that?
Michael helped me. Because I mean, all my equipment that I had at that point, up to that point, was shit. Everything was falling apart. I went into the studio. I had a beat up PV head, a homemade cabinet with two 15s in it. And it was just so boomy and awful sounding. So Michael's like, let's get you through four 10s and one 15. So we changed to that. And then he had an SWR head with the separate crossovers for each string. And we dialed in this old, I got a 78 Mocha P bass that I have played.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, I have played on everything. And actually, I only played a little on this newest record. I played this other P bass and a Spectre. But we worked on it a lot. Like, we worked at least a day on getting that tone right, because he just kept asking me. He's like, what? He goes, give me examples of bass tones you like. And I go, I love the how clear Paul McCartney's bass is, his tone. But I love the how vicious Gene Simmons' bass tone is. And I said, if we could get a mix in Dennis Dunaway from Alice Cooper, if we could get settle somewhere in there, I want it to sound like very percussive, like a piano, but if you're playing with the pedals on the piano smashed to the ground, you know, so it's just wide open. And so that's what we did. We worked on that for a good day and a half, and then that's what we came up with.
Well, I'll tell you what my first professional record did, and I'm sure you could attest to this looking back. It really got me to listen not only to myself, but to the rest of the band. It wasn't all about me. Now we're on a click track. Now I'm going, wow.
Yeah.
You know, I never knew the terms play behind the beat, play ahead of the beat.
Right.
And you're learning those things that just continue in your career to just
sure.
to develop. And it's so awesome. At the end of chorus one, 18 in life to go, and it's like a O-E-O-E-O that Sebastian does. And then there's, I don't know if he's saying, it's almost like a sigh of relief. It's like, sigh. Again, it's one of those.
Yeah.
You recall
I think that was just in the moment type of thing.
Right. Yeah. Okay. And
or maybe he had a leak. I don't know.
did Michael mix the record?
Yeah. Yep.
He did. Yeah. Okay. So maybe he left it in there. But at the very end of the chorus, there's a dual harmony guitar part that comes in, one pan left and one pan right, just real quick. There's just a little bit of nuance there before verse two. in his heartbeat, his veins burned gasoline. It kept his motor running, but it never kept him clean. They say he loved adventure. Ricky's the wild one. He married trouble, had a courtship with a gun. So there we're talking about that gun from earlier. It's actually in the lyric.
Yeah.
Pretty cool. Lyrics here.
Yeah. And now it starts to point out his issues. You know what I mean?
He's obviously drinking
and things running through this guy are bad. Killing his heartbeat, his veins burn gasoline. It kind of says it there. Everything in him running through him, that's kind of metaphor for this guy's soul.
Well, at the end of chorus one, something I didn't mention, the guitar pan left is doing these stabs on the one, and that continues into verse two. I love those little stabs. Yeah. It's not there in verse one.
No.
And that's just the song's just building. You recall that happening with Michael?
Michael. That's Michael. He goes, I want you guys to look at, and I'm paraphrasing, but he said, I want you guys to approach a song as a set of stairs, and every part you're stepping up every part until you get to the top of the stairs. And that just resonated to Snake and I, especially as songwriters. You know, it's like, okay, we get this. So we added that those stabs in there, and then I kind of played off what the guys were doing. And if you hear it, it's almost a counterpoint between the bass and the guitars, just for that one little snippet in there, and then it goes back to just the regular pattern. But yeah, this is one of those songs where when we get to it in the set, I get really excited because I just love playing that bass line. I love it because there's so many dimensions and textures to it. You know,
you should be really proud of it. It's really good. In between, it kept his motor running, but never kept him clean. Those big guitars come in like they came in verse one. But what's interesting here, they don't have the impact of verse one because the second verse is more rocking. Mm. But they're still there.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Which is great. But it's interesting talking about the song building. This doesn't really lift it there. It's there. It doesn't have the impact of verse one. But it's cool that it doesn't here. In this particular section, the second half, the guitars go eighth note again with those chord stabs, like chin, 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 and the stabs happen. On Ricky's the Wild One, there's a pinch harmonic off to the right there. On He Married Trouble, there's a really cool delay on Sebastian's voice on the word trouble there. I'm sure Michael had something to do with that in the mixing stage.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure. Yeah.
In the last line, there's a subtle pinch harmonic, very subtle off to the right. So talking about the song building, there's a bunch of little ear candy moments that are happening here at the back half of verse two.
Yeah, yeah. And that's Michael with suggestions and just throw this in there. And then it's great because, as you know, when creativity is infectious and when someone starts coming up with stuff that just spurs something in your own head, you know? So I just remember the song, like stuff that we hadn't already done and stuff that we haven't had set in stone, didn't have set in stone. It like these little creative bursts, boom, 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 would pop up. And I would imagine there was a lot more on there. Michael had to weed through and just pick the best out of them, you know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's better to have more than less. I love pre-chorus too, Rachel. Bang, bang, shoot em up. You could have easily went back to pre-chorus one. He had no money, no good at home, walk the streets a soldier. But the lyrics here, because you're telling a story here, that it had to be a different set of lyrics, which is almost a little scary in a sense, because you want that familiarity. You want the audience to be able to sing a lyric they've already heard. But I think it was integral. I think it had to be different for pre-chorus two.
I agree. We tend to do that a lot when we have a story that's pretty detailed, and because sometimes when you go back and use the first B verse again, it kind of cuts the story off. We could have maybe left it, but we still had the bridge to get to, the lyrics in the bridge. So Yeah, we felt that it was necessary to have continual lyrics throughout this whole song.
And what's so cool with me doing this show and breaking it down is how many times have I heard 18 in life in my life? And I never really realized, wow, these are different, the pre-choruses, but it has to be for this song. It's so cool. The lyric is bang, bang, shoot 'em up. So you get another gun reference in there. Bang, bang, shoot 'em up. The party never ends. You can't think of dying when the bottle's your best friend, and now it's.
Yeah.
So you're getting his troubles again coming in here on this.
Yeah, place. And it's like, you know, bang, bang, shoot him up, the party never ends. It's like, you know, he's not really taking this seriously. He's not taking himself seriously. It's like everything's a party and waving a gun around like an idiot, you know what I mean? Because he's so deep down in his own darkness and with the bottle or whatever, you know, and a lot of stuff is metaphor, but it's just showing how dark things really are for the character.
I'll tell you something else I love, and you know that this was done analog because there's no copy and pasting going on here. I talk about that a lot on this show. I like the now it's on this pre-chorus is different than the first one. Sebastian goes up there. Mm-hmm. It lifts the song. Do you remember Michael talking about those things, of how it's got to continue with the theme of building the song?
Yeah. I remember him saying, you don't want everything to be exactly the same because you guys will be robots. You know, this isn't what you guys are, you know, not at all. That always kept us kind of thinking ahead of ourselves in a good way, mm-hmm. not getting ahead of ourselves, but thinking ahead of ourselves and just thinking of what is going to make this part better. And that's why there's little things that are different. You know what I always equated to? It's like you've been playing a song you guys have been doing, say, fucking 15 years.
Yeah.
And you play it live. I guarantee you are not playing it this way now than you were 15 years ago. You know what I mean?
Yep.
Because you keep hearing stuff and you're like, oh man, this is kind of cool. You know, you have to stay within a parameter or people are going to be like, what is he doing? You know, but
yeah,
it's the same way, but in a shorter space of time. Within a song,
sure.
You know?
That's a great analogy, and I've had songs come on shuffle before of an album, or a song I haven't heard of my band forever. I go, oh, I don't sing it like that anymore.
You know, exactly.
And sometimes the fans will call you out for it too. I've had that happen.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
We get. I love where it goes. The now it changes on that pre-chorus. It's great. It just lifts into chorus two. Here's something else. There's so much going on in the story here with the lyrics, in all the verses and the bridge and everything, that I love that the chorus is the same every time, mm-hmm. because you don't need any more information. I think it's genius. I never realized that until I started studying this. It's just
funny. Yeah.
Yeah. You can't put any more information there. You already have the song. You just have to drive home the hook. 18 in life, you got it. 18 in life, you know. So chorus two is exactly the same. On 18 in life to go, the fourth line, the melody goes up here. It's different from chorus one. Love that. Harmonies are the same as chorus one. They're very subtle in the same places. And then at the very end, it says, and it's 18 in life to go. And there's like a yeah that Sebastian lets out. And there's a killer bass run that leads into the bridge. It's super loud and crisp. And I'm sure Michael floored that there. But yeah. Man, your tone's ripping there.
Thanks. Yeah. He got exactly what I was hearing in my head. He got that tone that I didn't want you to just feel the bass. I wanted you to actually be able to hear the notes. And he was into that idea because a lot of bands that came out back then, you know, unless it was like a Billy Sheehan or something like that, you really just felt the bass more than anything. And I wanted to be, you know, when I listen to Kiss, I hear Gene's walking bass lines and whatnot.
I call it lead bass.
Yeah.
I got a guy in my band. He's a frustrated guitar player. We call it lead bass.
Right.
Yeah.
So and I always tell people like bass, young bass players that ask for advice, I go, know your place in a song. You know, you're not gonna if the guitar player played a solo from the first downbeat to the last one, you're going to be pissed. I said, you have to know how not to get in the way of the song. And you could do really cool shit in that time, but you cannot get in the way of the song because the melody and the structure, the end product, the end result of the song is the most important thing, not just one of its components.
Pick your spots and know what not to play. That's the hardest lesson.
And then get the hell out of the way and let other things talk. And let big people talk.
Exactly. Well, this bridge is probably, probably one of my favorite parts of the song. It's just awesome. Accidents will happen, they all heard Ricky say. He fired his sick shot to the wind. That child blew a child away. And that line right there, that's the surprising line that got on MTV to me. That's some pretty graphic imagery.
Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of, this is where everything comes to a climax. You know, it's like accidents will happen. They heard Ricky, he's so nonchalant about what's about to happen, or it's kind of putting the cart before the horse. It's like accidents will happen. They all heard Ricky say, it could have been said when or after he fired his six shot. We're implying like it's after he fired the bullet and killed his friend. He was like, accidents will happen. You know what I mean? And just took it like with a grain of salt. And that's it's implying the timeline is kind of reversed, but I always love stuff like that.
Well, I'll tell you else what is awesome about this bridge is the guitar panned off to the right is doing this low register like counter melody part there.
Yeah.
That only happens that time in the song. It's very different texture and feel. Mm-hmm. Again, was that something you recall being the demo, or was that something Michael orchestrated in the studio with you guys?
Man, that's another, let's roll the tape on, because I think that was a suggestion from Michael, but I'm not 100% sure. All I know is I kind of weaved in and out of that on the bass, just little things here and there. I'd pick up some part of the riff and then just lay back on the other parts. So,
in all due respect to you, us musicians, we don't sit around and listen to our own stuff. So I'm telling you stuff about your songwriting. You're probably going, wait, what are you talking about?
Yeah, no, as it comes up, here's a funny thing. I'm not thinking of the recording. I'm thinking, wait, okay.
How do you do it live?
So Snake stands to my right on stage. Scotty stands to my left. Who played that? I know. I hear it every night. But
I'm like, I got a drummer behind me pounding away at 110 dB. Yeah. I don't know what's going on.
Exactly.
Well, the very last line, the guitar opens up on child, blew a child away. Mm-hmm. And that's essentially what's like the start of the guitar solo. Yeah. And that soaring vocal that takes us into the guitar solo. Guitar solo is 16 bars. The solo is panned pretty hard off to the left. And I love that with two guitar bands, Judas Priest, the Iron Maidens, where you really get that separation. You get to hear the nuances of each guitar player. It's just not just carbon copy stereo guitars doing the exact same thing.
Yeah.
And the guitar on the right is playing big chords, and the bass is mimicking the guitar arpeggio part from the choruses because the solo section's the same progression as the chorus. And that's awesome how you kind of change there in that part.
Oh, thanks. I wanted to lay back a little bit, but I didn't want it to be boring. The solo, that's Scotty Hill. The idea to start the solo that early to this day still blows my mind, because
It's odd, right?
Really odd, but it's so Scotty Hill. And just, all right, that's like somebody revving a car. You know what I mean? Revving their engine before the light goes green. And that always blew my mind. I'm just like, man, what an awesome idea that was. It really sets it up.
I never thought, again, I've heard this song hundreds upon hundreds of times, mm-hmm. and it never dawned on me until I really broke it. Oh, wow, That guitar solo comes in the oddest of places, yeah. But it works.
It really,
so good.
Really does work. Yep.
Yeah. Well, there's a yeah that happens before chorus three. And chorus three, again, is just, you know, what I'm calling a double chorus, but it's the same as chorus one and two. On the fourth line, again, 18 and life to go, he says, go, whoa. It changes there from chorus two. Again, just another subtle change. And then on the very last line, and it's 18 and life to go, the guitar solo comes in, it's panned right, which the other solos were kind of panned left, so it's interesting. Now your ear's taking you over here, it's panned off to the right, it's for 16 bars on the outro here, and at the very end there's some cool vocal operatics that happen before the song ends. You're doing some cool little bass, and the song just kind of dissolves and brings us to the end of it. Remember hearing this mix come back, and what did you think of it?
Yeah, well, Snake and I were there for the mix. We always stay till the very last day of everything. So we heard it a bunch, but when we got it mastered back, I was just like, holy shit. Like, just listening to it in headphones, and then I cranked it on my stereo and I was like, this is unbelievable. This is like,
it's A-League, man.
Yeah, and here's something really funny. We were kids. This is the first professional album we ever did. When we demoed this song, it was an electric guitar doing the beginning, and that's that. So Michael had Snake overdub an acoustic guitar with it.
Okay, I was going to ask.
I was so incredibly bummed out, and I was like, we're not going to be able to do that live. And I was so bummed out to the point where Michael came to my hotel room and was like, dude, what's going on? And I'm like, how are we going to play this live, man? He goes, this is production. This is production. It's not going to sound like there's another guy up there. It's just going to make this part bigger. You have to trust me.
And do you know why it's so good? Why it's so good? Not to cut you off, I have to interject, is because I had it written down here at the top. I hear acoustics. I'm like, I really thought that it was the chorus effect on the guitar. It is so subtle. I can hear it, but you can't. And it doesn't matter about live. He was right, but they are there.
Yeah,
they are there.
Yeah, he's like, he goes, this is texture. I'm adding texture to this guitar, and he goes, it's not going to be anything where it's a standout guitar part. It's going to be exactly what he's playing. It would be no different than if I had him double the guitar on the same guitar. It's just adding more dimension. And I was like, all right, I trust you. I was still mad. But then when I heard it, I was like, I told Michael, I was like, dude, you're so right. This is unbelievable, man.
Well, and also acoustic guitars are percussive.
Yes.
You know, you're hearing the pick.
He said you're exactly that, dude.
Well, we're going to wrap up here in a moment. But before we go, what would you like to leave the listeners with? What you got coming up? The new record? Any tours? What's happening?
Yeah, we have a new record. We have a residency in Las Vegas with the Scorpions that starts at the end of March. It's for 9 shows. We're really excited because we're all Scorps fans. You know, it's just going to be killer. We got a lot of shows planned for this year, a lot of traveling. And we're working on this new record, and we're going to get some new music out to everyone very soon.
Very cool. Well, thank you so much, man. I really appreciate you taking the time today.
This was great. This was a lot of fun, man. This is like one of the most fun, some of the most fun I've ever had on a podcast. This is great.
That means a lot. Thank you so much.
Yeah, man.
There's lots more Krista Makes a Podcast after a few words from our sponsors.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hey, Krista Makes a Podcast producer, Chris Fafalius here. You may have heard me talk about my band Punchline before. Maybe you already know us, or maybe you're hearing about us for the first time right now. It doesn't matter. No matter what your relationship with Punchline is, I will absolutely guarantee that you'll love our new podcast, A Band Called Punchline. Starting with our humble beginnings in a small town in southwestern Pennsylvania in 1997, we're telling the hilarious, strange, and hopefully inspiring story of the 25 plus years of our band in the most honest way possible, podcast style. A Band Called Punchline is an audio documentary available now wherever you get your pods. So subscribe and let me and my friends share a wild, entertaining, unique, and wonderful tale of music and perseverance unlike any other that's still being written today.
End of the show. Here's a band you might not know.
Welcome to this week's Band You Might Not Know. If you'd like your band to be considered for Krista Makes a Podcast, all you have to do is email your song via MP3 only and bio to bandyoumightnotknow@gmail.com. This week's featured artist is Downcast, a punk rock band from the UK. They have a brand new record out called I Saw Hell When I Was With You. You can find their music on Spotify, and here's a snippet of their song, Catharsis.
The Wrap with Chris and Chris.
Another episode right up your alley, Chris.
That's right. My 80s metal, heavy metal dreams are coming true on Krista Makes a Podcast. It's awesome. And Rachel couldn't have been any cooler.
I seriously agree. A lot of these 80s metal dudes that we've had, no offense to them, they've all been awesome. Awesome musicians, great storytellers and stuff. But I feel like there's always a little bit of like, I don't want to call it arrogance. I want to call it like, it's just like an attitude. It's like an 80s metal attitude. And I felt like Rachel Bolan is like the most humble 80s metal guy that I've ever heard talk on a podcast. You feel that way?
I really do. He like I said, he couldn't have been any cooler, super down to earth. And for those listeners that don't know, I mean, usually you associate the face of the band, the singer, in this case, Sebastian Bach, with writing the songs. And that's not the case here. You know, Dave the Snake Sabo, the guitarist, and Rachel wrote the lyrics and the music for all these Skid Row songs, all the hits. And, you know, I felt that they stood apart from their 80s and early 90s counterparts. So they had a little more depth to them. It wasn't all sex, drugs, and rock and roll. And there's a story here behind 18 in Life. And it's funny, in the episode, Rachel even said, yeah, it's something about Jersey, this the way we are, we tell stories, you know. And again, it's that Brian Fallon mentioned that on his episode, the Bruce Springsteen thing. I don't know what it is about Jersey, but you know, there's a story behind 18 in Life that sets it apart from what else was going on in the heavy metal, hair metal genre of the 80s.
Yeah, I mean, aside from it being great musically and melodically, there's a story. It sucks you in when you listen to this song. Yeah, that's something maybe you'll see a lot of times in country music. I feel like storytelling's very commonplace in country music, but you're right, man, especially in the 80s metal, especially like the cheesy 80s metal, there was just, like you said, it's sex and drugs and whatever, and it's kind of fluff.
in a way, but not this. This is like a heavy, serious story. And I think people really latched on to that.
Yeah, and I'm kind of surprised that no country artist, a pop country artist, has covered this song. I think it would translate really well to pop country radio. But yeah, you know, and during the episode I mentioned to Rachel, I was looking back, really surprised that MTV touched this. You know, it references shooting and a gun and killing a child in this, and pretty heavy for the time. Even probably more heavier now, considering everything that's gone on with guns and stuff in the U.S. So pretty surprised that MTV aired this back in the day.
And I respected him for saying, too, that if you're going to tell a story to a large audience, you have to tell it responsibly. I feel like a lot of his contemporaries and peers would be like, nah, man, I'm just going to say what I'm going to say. But he knows.
Yeah. And I wasn't trying to take anything away with my comments before about the songwriting with Sebastian Bach. I mean, the guy could sing The Telephone Book and just, I mean, the pipes on him. He really, really sold this lyric and sold this song. So props to the whole band. But yeah, I always liked this song. I felt that it was a good, it bridged the gap between their first single of the record, Youth Gone Wild, and the ballad, I Remember You, which was the third single. This was kind of right there in the sweet spot in the middle of them. And I think they picked the greatest songs, put their best foot forward with this record. The story of going to Minnesota to record with producer Michael Wagner was really cool. You know, he got into their psyches and said, hey, stop. We're not having fun. We're not being creative. Let's go skiing. Let's go jet skiing for a little bit, and we'll get back and start recording again when we're fresh.
That stuff about Michael Wagner was awesome in this episode. Just the fact that he knew sometimes you got to get out of there, dude. I've been there, and I know you've been there, Chris. You've just been in the studio too long.
Mm-hmm.
You need to get out of there sometimes. So I think that was a really good move to come back in there energized.
Oh, yeah.
Because, yeah, you don't want to make music sleepy or in a bad headspace or anything like that. I thought that was really, really awesome.
To this, you know, they had recorded, but it was basically demos. And here they are with Michael Wagner, world-renowned producer. He did everybody in the 80s and 90s on up. And he really appreciated those times. He's talking about his bass tone and like how he was dialing it in and giving Michael his influences to get the bass tone. And then hearing the mix back for the first time at 18, like being blown away with little things like Michael saying, we need to put acoustic guitar. He's like, we don't have an acoustic. How are we going to do this live? He's like, trust me. And when he got it back, you didn't really hear him, but you felt him. You felt the percussiveness of it. And just you could hear it in his voice. Such fond memories of that time.
You know, Rachel's also a bassist, so I had that in common with him. But I felt like one more thing I had in common with him was that he and I would have done the same thing. When you're talking about Michael Wagner and his, you know, all his accomplishments as a producer, the thing that Rachel called out was like, you know, he produced like the rock version of Janet Jackson, Black Cat, right?
Yeah.
Because when I was doing the research for this, I was like, damn, that's awesome. And I just love that he made mention of that, too, because it rocks. It's awesome.
Yeah, he was known as an 80s metal guy, but Michael had some good ears, man. He was one of the greatest producers.
I like that you got into a little bass tone talk in this episode. You know, that's not something you talk about every episode as a bassist. You know, I don't want to get too deep into talking about bass tone and gear and stuff, but I do agree that his bass sounds awesome on this song.
Bass sounds awesome and the parts are great. He really put some good parts down, and it was really cool to hear him, you know, talking again to Michael Wagner about what he was going for sound wise and how he was able to achieve that. He learned so much, and he didn't have any good gear. They didn't have any money, and you know, they're coming in, they're using all this professional gear, and it's really where he found his sound.
And I think that he had, speaking of sound, he had very sound advice for any bassists out there. And I feel this way strongly, too. But he said, as a bassist, you can't get in the way of the song.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you pick your moments. You can shine. You can definitely shine plenty of times in a song. But you also can't be, you know, thinking you're playing like lead bass through a whole song. Maybe Flea can get away with that once in a while. But yeah, I think that's tasteful bass is important.
Absolutely. And something else about shining, Chris. I love when people leave us a shining review.
Yeah, me too, man. It makes me feel like I'm a shining star when someone goes on Apple Music or wherever and leaves us a review. You know, that helps more people find out about the podcast and helps us get all those guests that we want to get and you want us to get.
Absolutely. And for those who don't belong to our Krista Makes a Podcast Facebook group, please join. It's a lot of fun, and give me a follow follow on Instagram at Less Than Chris D. I'd like to talk to you.
Yeah, man. And speaking of joining, hey, if you're not part of our supporting cast, maybe now's the time to join, because our back catalog of After Party episodes, ask somebody who's a supporting cast member what they think of the After Party. We put a lot of love into those episodes too. They come out weekly as, you know, kind of like supplementary to the podcast. Sometimes it has something to do with that week's episode. Sometimes it is something completely different, but it's always fun. It's a lot of music talk, and we have a lot of laughs on there. ChrisDeMakes.com. For a few bucks a month, you could help us continue making this podcast for all eternity. At least while Chris and I are here on this planet.
Absolutely. And before we wrap here, just want to thank this week's guest, Rachel Bowen from Skid Row, for sitting in with us. It was a lot of fun, and we'll see you next week.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law.
See terms and conditions. 18 plus. Bowie, Dylan, Marley. You've heard the names and maybe you've heard their songs. But what about the stories behind the records that made titans of music like these so universally loved and important? Join me, Josh Adam Myers, host of The 500, as each week I go through a different album from Rolling Stone Magazine's 500 Greatest Albums list from 2012 with an incredible lineup of comedians, actors, and musicians talking about how the music has impacted their lives. New episodes of The 500 come out every Wednesday. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.